Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Temperance Alden is the author of Year of the Witch and is a teacher and folk witch based in South Florida. Temperance has spent over 19 years of practice devoted to growing and developing her personal brand of witchcraft and paganism. She studied history at Salem State University and is currently working towards a BA in religion in South Florida. In her free time, she is most likely reading too many books and blogging her way through the internet. She runs the online community Wild Woman Witchcraft and loves teaching folk witchcraft to the next generation of witches.
Temperance Alden, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. I enjoyed your book when it came out and enjoyed rereading it this week. That's so twofer.
I mean, it's seasonal. It comes back and come back any time of the year.
Yeah, exactly. You dip in and dip out. So our first question for everybody on the show, since we're a show about writing, is why write, especially in this age of like social media and all that stuff, which I think you can probably especially speak to, why still write books?
I am a really big analog fan. There is a lot that can't be translated digitally. And there's a lot of digital stuff that can't be translated like analog, but magic is something you craft and craft it with your hands. And when you're writing, it's an act of magic, no matter if you're writing about witchcraft or not. You can be writing fiction and you're creating a whole world and it's seen. And you know, you're doing all that world building. You're doing the actual act of creation for that story. In a way, you're kind of like God. So, or you take that role. And so I think, you know, writing is just so, I just think back to my childhood and I was so, that there's that movie with Robin Williams, Dead Poets Society. Yeah. So like, I was just like super into that. Ended up getting into like that Johnny Depp movie, The Nine Gates, I think that's what it's called. And he's like an antique book dealer. And yeah, so I mean, like, I just like, I really liked that vibe of like writing, wanting to be in a coffee shop and writing and getting all those journals. And then, you know, you buy the journals and you don't ever use them. So, you know, writing has been a long journey, but it's really been an act of like creating again with my hands, with something that I can see. Because when you do it on the computer, you do all this work and then you just look at the bottom line, you're like word count, like 10,000. And it's just a screen and it doesn't feel like anything. But when you do it on paper in your hands, you're holding it or you're holding the finished manuscript in the book, you're like, yes, this, I made this, I forged this like out of my sheer will and thoughts.
Awesome. I'm going to pause. Your sound is going in and out. I'm not sure what's going on.
Oh, we can definitely retake that. Okay. Maybe because I'm moving around too much. I'll just stay still.
I talk with my hands too, I feel you. Okay. I think it's probably okay. But going forward,
we'll just keep moving on.
I just noticed like it would drop out a little bit. So, editor.
Oh, rest in peace, the editor. I'm so sorry. I know I'm a menace to edit because I edit my own podcast.
So what was your writing journey like? Like, how did you get started writing?
Oh, I can remember super vividly. I wrote this piece for my third grade. So I went to a school that did like these mini SATs at the end of the year, no matter what grade you were in. So I remember being in third grade and I had read the book Banicula. And so I did this long essay on Banicula, got graded horribly on it. I think I got like a D or something, but I was so proud of that essay because it was like a creative fiction piece. And yeah, that just kind of like started me wanting to figure. And then I got into like poetry when I was a teenager. I was like edgy with my little poetry stuff. I've recently been getting into romance writing. I've wanted to do it for so long and I always felt like there was a barrier between me and doing that. But part of the barrier is learning how to jump over the barrier and realizing like it's not about the finished product. It's about having fun and the journey along the way. And like writing is hard. Writing is really difficult. And so setting aside your expectations and your frustrations and just enjoying the act of creation. I keep trying to put myself back in that, the act of creation versus the finished product. It's about the journey. It's not about the destination, although it is about the destination.
Yeah. I mean, it is nice to have a destination and to have a finished book. There's two things that you said that I wanted to circle back to. One is that I am amused by writers who are also stationary hoarders, like with
hoarder,
you know, pens and paper and notebooks. I made a decision a few years ago that no notebook was too nice to write in. So now I just write in them. But I do have a pen issue.
I see, that's the thing. I always buy the notebook, right? I'll go to the store, I'll see the really nice notebook. I'm certain that Barnes & Noble stays alive just on my notebook purchases. I'll buy the notebook and I'll be like, yeah, I'm going to actually do it this time. I'm going to write in it, write two pages before I seize up and I'm like, can't go any further. I've been trying to break through that. And I figured out that the easiest way to break through it was to start by using notebooks that only cost me like 99 cents to get over my initial trepidation. And then I can translate the things that I want to save into the nice notebook. But then once it's being translated into the nice notebook, it becomes a thing of like, okay, well, how is my handwriting? And I only primarily write cursive. And so my cursive can be a, like, depending on how fast I'm writing, it can be really bad. So it's a fun journey, but I'm trying to be like you.
As long as you can read it. I mean, I journal a couple different ways. I have like a ongoing journal. I'm like a hardcore note taker, like for classes or on a call or anything. I always take notes. I have a notebook that's kind of like, I did bullet journal for a long time, but I got to where it was just too much arts and crafts time. I'm like, if I'm going to use my arts and crafts time, it's going to be besides drawing out calendar grids. So I found a calendar book I like, and then I have a separate notebook. But I found a notebook that I like, and I just buy stacks of them, and that's what I use, so that they're always the same. Sometimes the color changes because they'll have a deal on a certain color cover.
What's the notebook?
It's this one by Chronicle Books. It's called the Go-To Notebook, and it has, I will show Temperance, but y'all won't be able to see. It's got the corners docked,
so it
doesn't get as ragged, and it has those Kona covers like on the old three ring notebooks that you could draw on that kind of look like denim, but it comes in burgundy.
Check the show notes. I'm sure we'll link it.
Yeah, I'll put a link to them. I love them. I used to get them in gray, and for some reason the price of the gray ones has gone up, so now I get them in burgundy. But they have a pocket in the back, and I just, the pages are already numbered because I do the bullet journal index thing in my notebook, so I can go back and check it. But
So what are you indexing? Oh, I know this is my interview, but I'm just so curious because I always see those indexes and I never know what to put there. What are you actually putting on the index?
So I put, like, if it's notes for class, I'll put like the page number and then the class so I can go back and look at it. Or if it's like notes I took while reading a book, I'll put that. If it's from a call, I'll put that. It's mostly just like a note of where that thing is. I used to color code the corner in the pages, but I just got bored with doing it. So now I just put stuff in the index, and sometimes I'll highlight it if it's something I go back to a lot. I have found though, more than two notebooks back, I rarely go look at them. So after that, I put them in a box.
Yeah, that's about how it, I have a whole bookshelf of just notebooks.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things, but I like having them. And I joke with my son that, you know, if anybody wants my papers as a writer, like, I don't know why they would, but if they do, you'll have something to give them. You know, there'll be something you can give them.
Yeah.
Oh, but the other thing you said was Funicula. It was like one of my favorite books when I was a kid. I absolutely adored Funicula.
I love Funicula. And I've recently reread it as an adult. I think it holds up. I'm not going to lie. I think it holds up for a children's book. It's still entertaining. I see why I liked it so much the first time. I'm a big vampire fan anyway, and I had already been a vampire fan. But Funicula just kind of like introduced like cohesively. I think if you read Funicula as a kid, you probably had a Twilight phase.
I was a little old for Twilight, so I kind of missed out on that. I did have a vampire face, but mine were with Anne Rice.
Okay. Well, but how do you feel about the new series coming out? Have you seen the trailers?
I have seen the trailers, and I think it looks really beautiful. I know initially, before Anne Rice died, she was involved and her son was involved, but I don't think he's executive producer anymore. It looks beautiful. I'm weirded out that they changed the time that the books are set.
Yeah, that's the thing I noticed, because that was really actually kind of important to the plot, but I digress.
Yeah, so
it was important for Louis.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens, but I'm willing to give it a chance. But yeah, I did have a vampire face. Have you ever seen the animation of Funicula?
I haven't.
There was an animated television short. I don't know if it's available anywhere, but the thing I vividly remember is the draining the carrots of their color and the carrots turning white.
I think that's so funny. I think it's so cute. Yeah, my kid read Funicular recently and was talking about carrots and tomatoes getting drained. So
yeah. Yeah. It may be on YouTube. I haven't looked. We'll have to go look and check. See if it's available. Yeah. So how much of your life is actually writing? Like, how much writing do you do versus the other stuff that you do?
I probably read way more than I write. I try and write at least 100 words a day. And I know that's a low threshold, but I'm kind of like a burst writer. So when I write, when I sit down to write and I know I'm going to be writing, I'll do like 8,000 to 10,000 words in a day. But I don't usually do that. That's like, I do that like once or twice a month. So on a normal day-to-day basis, I just try and get like about 100 words of something, of stuff. Okay. And it doesn't have to be structured. That's, I try and keep myself like, I don't need to structure this. I'm just writing to write. I keep a journal every night, and it's not like a journal about my life. It's just like a running list of the thoughts that are happening in my head, because sometimes I think about things and I will forget them instantly, because at the end of the day, like, my brain's just gone. And I'll look back and I'll be like, what was I on last night? You know, like, because it'll be like those sleep thoughts, like right as you're going to bed, and they're like those half awake, half asleep, but like really cool, could be used in writing, maybe couldn't be. Secrets and answers to the mysteries of the universe all exist in that space, very liminal time.
Yeah. So what, are you working on a romance novel now, or are you working on like another nonfiction book about witchcraft?
I am editing a nonfiction book about witchcraft. It's kind of like already done. I've been going back and forth with it with my editor for a while, but I've been passion projecting a vampire romance. So I initially thought it was not going to be a vampire book, but I think it will be now. And I'm at the fun, hard part where it's way easier to write a fiction book if you already know the plot. So I'm trying to get the plot down, and I've been trying to research, you know, really how does the three scene or whatever, three story structure work? Because I'm not a writer by trade. I do something else. So how does this work? How do you make the plot points? And so I'm kind of really working through the math of the plot before I do the actual hard writing. I've got some scenes, but I want to make sure they all like flow and there's a reason for why they exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a group of writer friends, and we always joke about, like, are we pantsers or plotters? And when I started writing, I was definitely a pantser, although I've joked on the podcast before, and I prefer the term discovery writer instead of pantser. But, you know, I have friends who are like hardcore outliners. And so now that I've written more books, I do kind of do this like hybrid version of, like, I know like where the story starts, I know like the climax, and I know the ending, and then I just write and fill in the middle of that. So, but I can't stick to an outline. It's just not how I write.
I think I need like the, I need to see the vision, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, because I'm very much a tangent person, and I do a bulk of my writing. I know this is going to sound sacrilegious to some people. I do a bulk of my writing on voice to text. And mm-hmm. So I dictate nearly everything I write, which is why I can do like those crazy word counts. It's not hard to talk 8,000 words in a day. I promise that it's not. So, yeah, I can get like really off track really fast. So I need to see kind of where I'm going to make sure like I'm still going in the right direction, because it's very easy for me to like take that left hand turn and just go God knows where.
I think the dictation thing is more common. I have a friend who does it. She started because she was having carpal tunnel issues, and now that she just prefers to write that way. And that's
I have carpal tunnel. That's why I started.
Yep. And she can hit those crazy word counts too. I'm thinking like 10,000 words a day. A, my wrists would be bleeding. And B, that's like, I think my highest day ever was like under 5,000, like right under 5,000. That's a huge day.
But so, if you're talk to texting, yeah. See, the thing about talk to texting is it's a scam 100% of the time, because you're like, yeah, I'm doing great. I'm hitting thousands of words in the hour. I'm getting 2,000 words an hour. Look at this. And then you go back through and the voice dictation has like mistranslated half the words you said. And you're like, what was I saying? What was I trying to say? What am I?
And so the editing on a voice dictation takes way longer than the actual dictation.
Yes, I would believe that. Having edited, we use AI for the transcripts for the show and I edit them. And yes, I mean, they are amusing sometimes, but also frustrating to the point that if I didn't have the recording, I would have no idea what the transcript said.
Yeah. And if you have any accent or any words are accented, God bless you, because it's going to be rough.
Yes, I can tell you from experience that people with most kinds of British accents, AI does better with the, I have much fewer mistakes with people with British accents. Which, as a Southerner, I'm offended. But, you know, hey.
I'm surprised. Maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a bias there that we can investigate later.
Yeah, I don't know if it's an enunciation thing. I don't know what it is. I have not interviewed a Scottish person
I'm
yet.
Sorry,
so
but just like the accent is playing in my head, and I just can't see it like a voice dictation, like "Oi, bro, governor," something like that, and then like having it translate properly. I don't know. Sorry for any British people listening.
Yeah, it depends on the British accent. I mean, there are a range, you know, like here, but for the most part, the folks I've interviewed, the AI does a little bit better. I have fewer mistakes with those. It's just a weird thing. But I guess back to writing. So because you're dictating, like I wonder, like, you know, I have a few rituals when I sit down to write. Do you have rituals around that when you're dictating, or do you just kind of like catch it when you can?
I usually schedule myself a time to write. Like I clear my whole schedule for like a day, because the way I write, I have to be sleep deprived first. And so I'll clear like a whole day off, like on a Saturday. I'll wake up super early. I like to start writing at like 4 a.m. So I'll wake up super early and light a candle. I have some like incense and some candles, and I do some petition work. And then I just start dictating until my voice hurts. And then I'm done for the day. I take a nap. And then I wake up and I try and edit it. And then the candles go out. But I burn like big jar candles through the duration of the writing.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. And it is nice to be able to have like kind of a set thing to do. It's always interesting to me. Like some writers are just like, no, literally I wrote half this book on my phone in the car waiting to pick up my kid from work or from school. And I'd be like, my brain couldn't work that way. So I'm just always impressed with the way people do it. And I think it goes to show that however you can get it done, that's how you get it done. It doesn't matter.
I get my best work done on airplanes. I'm not going to lie. Like I find myself on airplanes at least twice a year. And I'm always on an airplane in the fall because, you know, you're like seeing family and stuff. So, I do a lot of writing in airports. I really like doing writing in airports. It, I don't know, it makes me feel like productive or something, because being in the airport feels like wasted time.
Yeah. Do you type when you do that? Or are you?
I do type.
Okay. I was like, I'm trying to imagine like everybody around you while you dictate your book.
Yeah, I'm going to just dictate a book on witchcraft in the middle of an airplane. It's really casual and cool.
You know, why not? Why not? What did getting your first book published look like? Because you kind of had like an online presence first, and then your book came out. So how did that work?
I have loved Wiser Books since I've been buying witchcraft. I remember my first witchcraft book that I ever bought for myself was a Wiser title. And that book was The Psychic Vampire Codex by Michelle Belanger. And so I bought that book when it came out. It's a Wiser old backlist title. And I pretty much just always kind of stayed within that. I gravitated towards the Wiser books over the Llewellyn books. It's just personal pro, because Llewellyn books at that time, a lot of them were being, this is the early 2000s. A lot of those books were being written like Wicca books, and I didn't find myself to be a Wiccan. I wasn't interested in it. So I gravitated towards a lot more of the Wiser titles. And then I started a social media page, and I tagged every publishing house and author that I was reviewing books on. Yeah, right. I mean, the connection just kind of like formed naturally. So I had already, they were aware of who I was at the time. I was looking at maybe writing a book. I was so frustrated with the way the topic that I wrote the book on was being handled in the community at large that I was like, I'm going to write this book. I want this book written. And so I just kind of like proposed. I didn't go in with any set plan. I hadn't written a single word of it. I was just like, I'm going to propose this. Shot my shot. Here we are today.
Yeah. I know, it's funny. I will share. This is a story I've never shared with anybody except my husband. So you get a Victoria story. So one of the reasons I found your book is because I was interested in doing a book about building your own wheel of the year. And then I found your book and I was like, well, somebody already did it. So I don't need to write that book. I'll write something else.
I think there's room for everyone. Everyone does it differently. I think there's room for everyone. So we just can't call it You're the Witch.
And call it anything else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, mine was kind of more, and this may still happen, but I kind of like the idea of like every day is that you could find a reason to do something every day. And there is another book similar to that. Oh, I cannot think of the woman's name. But it's basically like 365 days of witchcraft, but it's more like there's a spell and something every day. So it may happen down there. Right now I'm writing fiction, so it could happen later. But that was how I came across your book to start. And then I kind of found your social media. So I kind of discovered you backwards, I guess, from a lot of people.
A lot of people discovered me backwards. I think that's okay. It's a different, as odd as it sounds, it's a different print audience than internet audience. So the different, like, people are looking for different things when you go to different medias, right? Because some people really want the music and the photos and the aesthetic witchiness, but some people really just want information, or they want to be in the comfort of their own home, and the electronics can overwhelm them. So maybe they don't spend a whole lot of time on the internet. I'm not saying that I'm everywhere, but you know, like, there's just, they're different audiences. So I've heard it both ways.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine though that having had a social media presence helped when you're like doing a book proposal.
Yes, because at the end of the day, like, let's be honest, right? I lose nothing by saying this. Let's be honest about it. Publishing is an industry. It's a job. It's a business. It's a business model. Publishers don't publish books that they're going to lose money on. So if you are an author, or you're writing, or you want to be an author, or you want to be a writer, having any kind of platform that you can look at, whether that's an email list, a social media following, a blog, whatever you have that you're like, hey, I have this set group of people that are already built in that want to read more of what I'm doing. That's always going to look good to a publisher when you're proposing, no matter how big or small the house is.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I think it's important for writers to hear that too, because I do think people who are not in the industry or adjacent to the industry, you know, there's still, especially like in popular media, there's still this idea that like writers get treated like royalty when they publish. And I'm like, yes, if you're one of like 10 people.
If you're Stephen King. I mean, the truth is, at the end of the day, you're going to be expected to market your own book. And can you do it? Do you have the means necessary to market your own book? And that's definitely not a detractor for anyone. But if you come into writing thinking, oh, I'm going to make so much money and everyone's going to know my name, this is not going to be the job that pays your bills primarily. Unless you are the Stephen King of your genre, this is not going to be the job that pays the bills. I'm sorry to say it. I wish, but you know, most writers do something else with writing, or they have a partner that is able to support them and their journey. It's writing is very difficult to maintain full time, even with a platform. I have 3 jobs and I have a large platform. So, I mean, it's just kind of, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, the few people that I know that are writing kind of, you know, like, I know romance writers who are writing full time and that's what they do, but they also publish like sometimes up to 6 books a year. I mean, they're like,
they're publishing a lot. They're going fast.
Because I think very early on, first episode, I talked to Corey Thomas Hutchison, and he was saying the only witchy person he knew who was, you know, able to make a living writing books is probably Morgan Daimler. And it's because they publish so much. I mean, they just have published a lot of books. So there's a lot of back catalog to sustain. Because you know, the new book gets a pop and then it kind of falls off people's radar, and it's
you may do great the first couple of months, and then you're like, oh, look at that, like, $4 royalty check.
And I was reading something recently, because there's the antitrust thing going on with England, Simon Schuster, all that. I was reading something recently that came out in those findings that was like half of the signed authors sold less than 12 books.
I saw that.
Like, something like, what, two-thirds sell less than 2,000. So, yeah, I mean, really, the smaller your niche is, the better odds are that your work will sustain longer, because there's not as much going on within the niche, just pulling out a full-time new author. So even though witchcraft has expanded exponentially as a genre, it's still a pretty small pool overall. So it's a great niche to be in, but something as broad as romance, you really have to have, like, contemporary romance especially, or like the rom-com romance. Those are really hard to break into. The fantasy romances are getting more popular too, so it's a much larger genre. I think, like, romance is the largest grossing genre.
It's almost half of publishing. Yeah.
So it's, like, way harder to have kind of a big break, so to speak, versus in a niche where your big break could be 2,000 books.
It's a funny business, and you're right. I mean, most writers do have either someone else, a partner or someone else that they're kind of supporting themselves. That we all be independently wealthy and consider and write books, that'd be great. That's not how it works. Or I saw today Ireland is paying like 2,000 artists like a universal income.
That. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's what we need. That's what patrons should be. You just get a universal income and do your
universal
art.
Income. But I want to be able to artist universal income for readers. Like, I could spend my whole day reading books.
See, you get a job doing reviews. That's how you do that.
You should get a job doing reviews.
And then, unfortunately, you don't always get to pick what you want to read, though, with those gigs.
So. I'm so picky. I wouldn't say I'm a literature snob, but if I'm reading a romance book and they're not having sex in the first 150 pages, I'm done.
You do not like slow burn, is what you're telling me.
I do not like slow burn.
Yeah, it's funny. I think by the time this comes out, so I'm working on a anthology with some friends that will have come out in October by the time people listen to this. And we were all joking, they're short stories, so you got to get to the thing fast. And they're all cryptid shifters. So it's...
You'll have to send me this when it's available. I have a group that will want this.
All right. There you go. I'll make sure you get the deets. Yeah. So... And we threw in some legendary, like, one of the stories is about Krampus, because, we were making the rules so we could make Krampus a cryptid.
I think, I'm not even kidding. I run a romance book club and they will want this. So okay, you send me that link.
I will send you the deets. I'm excited for it to come out. Yeah, I was joking. I was talking to a friend today. And since I started writing, I've published a book a year, and this year was not looking good. Like, I didn't think there was anything going to happen this year, because the new book I'm working on is taking forever. And so this is coming out this year. So I still have something coming out this year, but I guess when people listen to this, it'll be last year, because it'll be 2022. But so that's where we are. Well, cool. Well, I'm excited when you get your romance out, your vampire romance out in the world to read that.
I want to do it so bad. I would love to see it's not a spoiler. I would love to see a romance book that was written like Spike and Buffy. What if they had gotten together? That's the ship that I want. That's what I'm going to write. Although I don't want it to be fanficky, but kind of like how 50 Shades was a Twilight fanfic. It'll have that flavor.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think there's room for all of those kind of things. And I have stood on this soapbox before that. I think, a lot of times people do kind of look down at genre writing, especially romance. And I'm always like, A, there's a little bit of misogyny there, because it's largely a field written by women for women, even though, that's not even true anymore, that's 100% the readership or the writers. But, genre fiction is something that's existed since novels existed. It's not a new thing, and it's, the writing isn't worse because it's a genre novel.
Yeah.
So there's some great romance out there. There's great, sci-fi. It's all it's all good. So I will say I'm not a literary snob, but I also think great writing can happen anywhere and bad writing can happen anywhere too. Let's be honest.
I guess like I'm going to backtrack my literary snobness. And I just want to put the caveat in there that I read way too much Kindle Unlimited. So that's why I feel like I've gotten this way, is because sometimes you read one of these and you're like, yeah, this is someone's first draft. This is someone's, they just put this out here. And then it'll have like, it'll have like 1,000 five-star reviews when you get to it. And you're like, okay, yeah, this is going to be great. And then you start reading it and you're like, what is going on here?
Yeah. I mean, I think their self-publishing has created a space where people can just type the end and then push publish.
Push publish. I mean, I love it for them. I just prefer the books that I read to at least have been gone through an editor at least one time.
Yeah.
It can be a privately hired editor, but you can tell when a book's been at least like looked at a second time.
Yeah. A little proofing, a little line editing doesn't hurt.
Just a tiny bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there are people who that, especially that Kindle Unlimited space and kind of now I think you see this too with like the serial reads like Vellum and or Bella and Radish and Kiss and, you know, these other ones that have come online that a lot of people are just reading for the story. It's you read like you would read fan fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there are a lot of readers who don't care necessarily about the quality of the editing and stuff like that. But if you're a reader all the time, it's hard for me to get past a reading in a book where like there's just typo after typo and, you know, the character's name is spelled differently multiple times.
Yeah. I get like if I'm on a fanfic site, I know what I'm getting. But if I'm on like my like an e-reader website, I just it's just a different bar for me.
Yeah, I guess this is not really related, but it made me think of it in my wool gathering brain. Like one of the things I enjoyed about your book, and I think it's important because I don't think it gets talked about a lot, and maybe more, and maybe your book is part of why that conversation is happening. But I do think there is, you know, witchcraft, and partly because of social media, has become about stuff and the aesthetic and your expensive, beautiful tools and your gorgeous crystals and all that. And the thing I like about your book is like, no, you know, you can do this with what you have in your kitchen today, right now, without leaving your house. And I think that aspect of it is really important to talk about. And one of the things I really enjoyed about your book is just this idea of, you know, and I always call it is witches make do. Like you just make things happen when you need to make things happen.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. I mean, I don't think I'm the first person to ever write it or think it. I think it's one of those conversations that when we look at how the witch has become popularized through media, and I don't mean through just social media, but through movies and books and all that stuff, you know, very glamorous almost lifestyle. I mean, Bewitched is very easy to pull on, but I mean, Practical Magic and tons of others. It's just like this, the craft, even there's this overlaid image of what a witch should look like and what that should. And then, you know, to do a real spell, you have to have these things and it should look this way. And then, God forbid, you pick up the wrong book for your first book and they're telling you, okay, you need to have this altar with this bowl and this cup and this color this and this color that. And it's like, I get the ceremony and I get the ritual. And I get why all that's happening. But you don't need the ceremony and the ritual to make magic happen, to make witchcraft happen. And especially me, as someone who practices folk magic, you don't need any of that stuff. So, you know, it's like really important. It was really important to me then. Still important to me now to like translate that it's not necessary.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good point about it's really popularized in like visual media too. I think, you know, I mean, Bewitched is like the ultimate suburban housewife magic, right? Although she could just do things by moving her nose. She didn't really need anything extra.
But she looked glamorous while she was doing it. So it imprinted this image because when we go back like even further in time, we have The Wizard of Oz. And there's, you know, anti-Semitic origins in there and there's a whole bunch of stuff. And that's another conversation for another time. But there was an image, the caricature of the witch and, you know, looking the way that she looked, and then Bewitched came later on. I mean, there was some stuff in between, but Bewitched looking very different, feeling very different, kind of almost giving like an empowered
energy to the witch. The witch could be beautiful. The witch could be desirable. The witch could have everything that she wanted. And on top of all that, there was the magic element. And then, you know, witch media after that very much was almost siren-y in a way. The witch was something to be desired versus something that was bad or evil. And it translated a lot in media. I think it translated the way a lot of people thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of people I know in witchcraft communities who are my age, like, practical magic is a touchstone maybe for them. Like, I guess the craft was for people who are a little younger than me. And I was thinking about it. My husband and I were watching something with Aidan Quinn and the other night, and I was like, I will never not think of him as the hot guy from Practical Magic. You know, it's just like, that movie is kind of an imprint movie. But yeah, I mean, it's both beautiful, desirable witches and a gorgeous house with every possible thing they could need, including, you know, this family book to make magic. And that's not most people's reality.
Margaritas was a massive, it still is, like, a lot of people's idea of what witchcraft could be, like the energy, not like the act of actual magic, the energy of what a witch is. You know, people think Midnight Margaritas, they think Hocus Pocus. And Hocus Pocus, I will say that, like, they didn't go out of their way to make the witches attractive, but they made Sarah Jessica Parker really hot for no reason in that film.
Accurate description. Yeah, it is interesting to me. I'm just fascinated by, like, the image of witch, you know, throughout time and space and media, different kinds of media, and what that looks like. And people definitely, I think, outside the community have their own ideas about that too. I would say witch community, like, it's all one big happy thing, but we all know it's not. It doesn't work like that. But you know, it's just one of those things that's interesting to dwell on. And as someone who writes fiction with witches in it, it's something I think about a lot, about what that means. So another thing about your book that I enjoyed, because this has always been one of those things for me, I came kind of into witchcraft in the late 80s, early 90s, and that was, you know, very Wiccan-centric. I didn't know anybody else practicing, you know, like, Wicca in a coven, you know, so it was kind of, you know, Scott Cunningham, solitary practitioner, that kind of thing. And they're just based on, you know, I don't live in Northern Western Europe. So the wheel of the year never lined up with my East Tennessee existence, which, you know, like, in South Florida. Yeah. In bulk is not a thing.
No. And, you know, I am from the North. I am not a true Floridian, but I've lived all over the place. And so, yeah, translating where you are is where the magic is. The magic isn't because Gerald Gardner said that on this day we're going to celebrate bread and on that day we're going to celebrate. I mean, really, when you look at the history of the wheel, it becomes a lot easier. There's a few assumptions that you have to dismantle. And I wish that, you know, going hindsight 2020, right? Or 50-50, or however, whatever the saying is. But after you write a book a few years back, you always think, oh man, I wish I kind of would have, like, touched on this a little more, or I wish I would have added that, or you gain more information, right? So if I could go back and add it in, I would definitely add in a little bit more about really the formation of the wheel and dismantling the idea that, I think a lot of people feel like they have to stick to this wheel because it gives them some validity to what they're doing, right? Like, other religions have holidays, so we have to have holidays, surely. And so they cling to this idea of what the pagan wheel is supposed to look like. But it's okay to admit what it's not. It's like 100% okay to admit Gerald Gardner put this together. He Mod Podged it together. And there were four. And then there weren't four because then they wanted to add some more because they wanted to see each other. They wanted to gather. And so they added more days. They added cross-quarter days. And there shouldn't be any shame in admitting what the origin to that was, because at the point in which we can say, okay, you know, this is how it was made, maybe I can change it up a little bit, we give ourselves back that power over our path, over our craft. And paganism as a whole is not the same, right? So when modern day quote-unquote pagans look at the wheel, when modern witches look at the wheel, if we're using the wheel that Gerald Gardner and Wicca later I mean, I guess it's not, I shouldn't attribute all of this to Gerald Gardner. He had other people
there
too.
Some stuff was as late as the 70s.
But, you know, the offshoots of Wicca, if Wicca has done this, I'm not Wiccan, so why do I have to do it? And my friend who's a heathen, they're obviously not Wiccan, so why do they need to do it? So, you know, it's one of those things that as a community, we've all kind of decided to adopt this calendar system, but acknowledging where it came from allows us to change it to fit our own practice. Because you can do a communal holiday, but have something else happen personally. You know, like if I'm doing the fall, well, at the time of recording this, the fall equinox is coming up shortly. It is not fall here. So I'm going to put up my little happy equinox post, and I might send, you know, some well wishes to my witchy friends in the north, but I'm not going to have that celebration for a few more weeks until the season starts actually turning. Yeah. I think that's like 100% okay to admit and take power back over.
Yeah. And one of the things I thought was interesting about it is you have like hurricane season and not hurricane season.
Yeah.
And I was like, because in California, like I'm still, you know, I've been here a year, but it's still like, I couldn't tell you what the actual signal is yet for when it's fall in California. Like, I don't know yet. And it's just kind of relearning all of that because I did come from somewhere with four seasons. They just weren't lined up with the British four seasons. But so it's been interesting to see that and making it about, I mean, I do think that's one of the directions that contemporary witchcraft has taken is this very like bioregional approach and really looking at where you are and, you know, what's, you know, what are the things in your area? What are, you know, the seasons in your area? What are the holidays that are important to you? I hope that people read your book and take that away from it, that you can be empowered to do that. I mean, there is some magic in thinking about everyone who's a witch, not that that's happening, are celebrating on this day something, you know. I think that is kind of, there's some kind of magic of that, of thinking about people all doing something on the same day, but I don't think that how it works.
It's a community magic aspect, but we have personal practice too, right? And I think that that's one of those things that also should probably have been translated better to the community at large. And I think in my critique, I don't know if you're going to cut this or not, but I'm going to say it anyways, because, you know, you only live once. I think that this is where the Wicca for the Solitary Practitioner discussion did people dirty, is because a whole bunch of people came into the community reading these Wicca for Solitary books, not recognizing that Wicca is a group practice. And so these holidays are designed to be community events. And so, yeah, bringing that into an individual level, you can shift that, you can adjust that, because this was made to happen communally. So we're going to, as a community, when that fall equinox happens, you better believe I'm going to be typing out happy equinox, but 3 weeks from now is when I'm actually going to celebrate it.
Right. Yeah. No, that totally makes sense to me. And like, you know, even when I did practice with a coven, like we didn't do it on the day. We did it on the closest Saturday. Let's all be honest about when those things actually happen.
Yeah. You do it when the group can do it.
Right. Yeah. So you've got other stuff in the works and all that, but one of the things that I kind of want to talk about, and if you don't want to talk about it, we can skip this question, but I do kind of like, once you kind of, because you do marketing coaching and things like that, is there something about like marketing yourself with books about witchcraft and also at the same time being a public witch, like, how do you think, like, what advice would you give and someone walking into that?
I think those are two separate questions, so I'll address them separately. The first thing, I'm going to take your second part first.
Okay.
Being a public witch, one, not for everyone. Two, you never have to be public fully. So as publicly available as I am, I only show maybe 25% of what I'm thinking or doing, or there's a lot of, if you're constantly making content for other people and showing everyone everything that you're doing, you're not really doing it for your own benefit. And isn't that the whole point of what we're doing, is for our development or for our benefit and going where we want to go? And sure, maybe your goal is that you want to get like super rich or famous, or you want to get like, you know, what, I don't know, whatever it is that you want to get. Well, I promise you that this is not the way to do it. I mean, the character of the witch is the outlier. It will never be a societally blanket accepted thing. And even in today's modern world, as much as I'm sitting in my place of privilege in America and someone on might call me like a lefty, radical pagan lefty for saying that. But, you know, as sitting in my place of privilege in the United States of America, there are people in this world right now being persecuted and killed as quote unquote witches who are not even practicing witchcraft. So
right.
Being public is not something you ever have to do. And then if you decide that you do want to do it, it's a choice of how much you get to share. You don't have to share everything. Not everyone deserves to know all parts of you. So that's that question. And then marketing. You are your best market tool. You wrote the work, your face is the work, your soul and passion went into that work. And so the best way, in my opinion, to market a book is to talk about the book, but not talk about what other, this is where I think a lot of authors get it wrong. No one gives a fuck what your reviews say. No one cares. So don't post your reviews on your page and be like, this person gave me a 5-star review or this person gave me a 1-star review. Does not matter. If someone comments to you and says, I like the book, you need to say, thank you so much. If you have time, will you please leave me a review where you bought it? If they bought it in person, obviously they can't. But you're directly asking a person who has just engaged with you to tell you that they liked your work. You're asking them, hey, you liked my work. Can you please help other people find it? That's how you kind of get those wheels moving. You get them turning because you need to keep engagement on your book's pages. You do. So if someone talks to you about the book, you're engaged back. And then you need to post about the book, but not like, I'm sorry. One of the things that I see that I don't find works for people is being vague about what's in the book. It shouldn't be a surprise what's going to be in the book. Obviously, you're not ruining all your plot points, and I'm writing a nonfiction, so this is not advice for a fiction writer. But yeah. In a nonfiction witchcraft world, if you've written something in there that's unique, you need to tell people that it's in there. So if I write about how to use climate-specific microclimates, okay, maybe that's what's in my book, microclimates. I'm going to put that up, magic of microclimates, or I'm going to put up budget witchcraft, or I'm going to put up, maybe you have a really cool section in your book about how to crochet poppets. All right, whatever it is, you're going to tell people, this is in my book, and this is why it's special. This is why it's unique, because there's a million books on witchcraft, but what makes yours unique? You're the best person to tell them why it's unique and why you're the right person to share that information. Because maybe I can crochet and maybe you can crochet, but maybe I know a technique that you don't know, and I know about knot magic. And so I'm going to incorporate knot magic and sigils into the crochet piece. And so I have the knowledge to give to you, which will enhance what you're already doing. You need to tell people why. I mean, I guess that's basic marketing, but why are you the person that's supposed to translate this material?
Now, why is it important that you're the person who read this book? Which I think you're right, is more of a nonfiction thing. It's almost like, what are the credentials you have
that makes this a book I want to buy? Your credentials are never going to be how long you've been a witch. Your credentials are never going to be what you were initiated into. Your credentials are never going to be that you took some certification course. Your credentials are going to be that you lived this experience, you have this knowledge, and you've written this book. Those are your credentials. Your credentials are that you wrote this book. Like, it doesn't, to me, I don't think that it will ever matter if someone's like, on the back of the book where it says, like, they've been a high priestess for 15 years. So how do I know that their coven, how do I know their coven's not a coven of one? Or how do I know that they're not a complete moron? Like, I don't know this person. So I'm just saying, I bet some high priestesses of questionable lineage, okay? So how do I know? That's not a credential to me. The credential to me is that you've lived this experience.
Yeah. No, I think that makes sense to me too, because like you said, you could say I've been a witch for 30 years, but maybe 25 of those, I didn't do anything.
25 of those years, you were in a coma. Were you really like...
Yeah. Or just in a, you know, cold spell with your witchcraft. You know, stuff happens. So,
So, I mean, yeah, definitely, like, if you're marketing yourself and you're marketing your book, you know, really relaying why you are the person that should be writing that and what's unique about it. Because there's a million books on witchcraft, but yours is unique because you wrote it and it's got your flavor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that goes to fiction in some ways, in that, you know, the story you tell is going to be unique because of your experience. Again, it's harder to market fiction that way, but the story is going to be because of those same things. It's just not as good a marketing point.
I love that, because I don't read any other genre but romance. Honest to God, maybe you're going to have to edit this because I don't know the rating of your podcast, but if they are not fucking,
because it's about witchcraft.
If they're not fucking in the first 150, like I said, I'm not reading it, okay? So I exclusively read romance, and I love watching fiction authors. What really gets me is they'll make a post on social media, usually like a TikTok or Instagram post, but it'll be from the perspective of their character. Like, I met this person and now I don't know what to do, or like, they sent this to me and blah, blah, blah. Like, those get me, because I'm like, okay, like, what, I'm now invested in what is happening, like the drama between these two people. And then I realize, oh, it's not drama between two humans, it's drama in a book. And then I usually end up going and checking it out and seeing.
Yeah.
I found one of my favorite authors that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think authors on TikTok and authors on Instagram, especially Reels, like, that marketing has come a long way. Like, you know, it kind of started with book trailers on YouTube, and it's really taken off with these more visual mediums.
I mean, TikToks and Reels are the way to go. If you're going to market a book right now, that's the way to do it. That's the fastest growing market for advertising. It's the easiest way to get yourself in front of thousands of people. Let's say you make a TikTok about your book and 3,000 people see it, you'll probably get at least one reader out of those 3,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The reach is, I think, a lot bigger for those. But, so now that we've talked about marketing, and before we get to our last question, I want to give you an opportunity to tell folks what's coming up for you and where they can connect with you.
I have a book coming out to be determined. It'll be out next year. I do have my book, Year of the Witch. It's available everywhere books are sold. I also have an accompanying planner and calendar. They are beautiful, by Amber Lotus. The art in them is just stunning. One is a desk planner. It's got a few additional spells in it. And the wall calendar, which I have been trying to decide how to use it. I have been using it currently as altar art. So it's not in year yet, because it is for the 2023 calendar, but they are available already. And like, the artist that worked on it is fantastic. It's amazing. It's just very centering.
Awesome. And where can folks connect or find you?
I'm on the internet. I am on the internet. I'm on Wobble Witchcraft on Instagram. I'm Temperance Alden on Twitter. I have an unused TikTok. Had to uninstall the TikTok app. Oh gosh, where am I? I have a Patreon, Wobble Witchcraft. I'm also on YouTube at Wobble Witchcraft. And it might be all of my platforms. Twitch, I'm on Twitch. So that is where you can find me.
Awesome.
What do you do on a podcast as well called Saltcraft?
Yeah. What do you do on Twitch?
Well, I used to stream Thanatophobia. Pretty sure that's what it's called. It's like a ghost hunting game. But lately I have been taking a break. I think I'm going to come back. And for a while I was actually doing live streams of just me typing, because I have like an old school typewriter that I like to use. Very ASMR. But I lately have been taking a break, but I do plan to return back at some point.
Cool. I like the idea of like typing ASMR.
So far,
last question, I'm going to roll a die. And okay. Listeners will know this is our tiny game of chance. And depending on what I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. I think we've touched a little bit on a lot of this already.
So this may just
be like follow-up questions. And then if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want. So.
Okay.
And I may have to change my sex question now. I know your reading habits.
Second.
Six. You get to pick.
I get to pick. Let's do death.
Okay. So I try to kind of rewrite the questions for everybody I have on the show. And one of the things I was thinking about with your book, because it is about personalizing your practice. So what for you would be the most important ritual around death, or what would you want like your loved ones to do at or after your death?
After my death, I picked death because death, most of my stuff is like death work. I pray to death gods, but I've never really put too much thought into my death. You know, I've always thought that I wanted to be cremated because I don't want to be in a box in the ground. I specifically don't. I would like to be dusted back into the earth at some point. But after that, I really just want, I would love to have like a full, the only way I can picture it is like a jazz, you know, like those New Orleans jazz funerals, but not quite like that. But like, I just want it to be like a party. Like I want, even though I know death is supposed to be a sad thing, like I'm not afraid to die in the least. So I really want my family to have a celebration for my life over a mourning of my passing, because we will meet again. I have no doubt of that. So like, let's just celebrate the life that I did have. I would love them to do that. I would love to be scattered. I would love to be scattered everywhere. I don't want to be, the only place that I would not like to be scattered is Disney's Haunted Mansion ride. Apparently a lot of people scatter ashes there, and I do not want my ashes scattered at Walt Disney World.
That seems so, that's such a weird choice to me, but.
Lots of people do it. There's tons of ashes all over that. It's super haunted, by the way. This is not even a lie.
I mean, I guess it's on theme. If you want your ashes scattered at Disney's Haunted Mansion.
It's apparently a crime to do it, too. You're not allowed to do it. They'll peek you out of the park.
Well, I mean, I guess that makes sense because, you know, it is. I mean, it's human. Cremains aren't really ashes. Like, it's mostly bone dust, but that's still kind of weird.
There's,
I don't know.
I'm just saying, there are. You could. Apparently, we got an annual pass to Disney last year. That's the reach. After we got our annual passes, my partner liked to watch these informational Walt Disney World videos. There's a lot of cremations throughout the Haunted Mansion yard. And there are real skeletons on the Pirates ride at California Disney.
Yes, I had heard about that. And apparently, like, the Poltergeist movie, which I think you probably are old enough to know, Poltergeist movie, when they fall in the pool, those are real skeletons, because at one time it was cheaper to use real retired medical specimens than to buy plastic skeletons.
Yeah, when the park is being made. So that's the only place I don't want to have my ashes spread. I've been thinking a lot about, there is the forest urn seed thing where you basically cremate you and then put you in a seed pod and then plant you in a forest. I've thought a bit about that too, but the way deforestation is working, I don't want my tree to die.
Yeah.
So, I mean, just scattered.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, you know, maybe I just have a morbid opinion about it, but life should be celebrated, not mourned at the end of it. Okay. So I'd rather live my life in a really full way. I was really inspired. I read a lot about, there's a text, and I would butcher the name, so I'll text you the title so you can read in the show notes. But there's this text written in like 15th century Europe that was the art of dying. But part of the art of dying is actually the art of living. And the point of it was like to live a life that was so fulfilled that when death came for you, because death could come at any time, that you wouldn't feel like you were, that you had unfinished baggage. So I've been trying to take that page out and really live like a life that's fulfilling, that I don't regret, that I don't look back on or wish I had done something differently, or that I did for a long time. I worked in a job that was just soul sucking and it was awful. And every day I was like, I wish I could do something different. I wish I could do something different. And one day I was just like, I'm not doing this anymore. Like,
no.
Life, it, like, none of this is guaranteed. I have to live this fully. And so I've been more really working on how to enjoy the current moment. And at the end, when it comes, I hope that everyone kind of, you know, puts me in a little box and puts me in my.
Yeah, I like that. And I do like the idea that, you know, to live your life well enough that, you know, when death comes, it's as a friend, you know, like this time. And you're ready to go. But no, I like that. I think it's a good answer. I mean, especially since you hadn't thought about it.
Hadn't thought about it at all.
Yeah. It's, I don't know. I probably because I'm a Scorpio, I will own that. And it is a theme in my books about death and what happens and what it means. But yeah, I think the main secret of a good death is a good life.
There's, I mean, that's a science. It's the art of dying.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll get that from you and we'll make sure we get that in the
show
notes.
Yeah, I'll give you the notes for it.
Awesome. Well, Temperance, thank you so much for being on the show. Thanks for your book. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, when you get your vampire romance out there in the world, let's chat.
We'll chat. So, we'll chat about my vampire romance.
It sounds great.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Kaifel Agostini. Our music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. You can support our work at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. And if you'd like to submit your own death, sex, religion, politics, or money questions, or have questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to victoria@witchlitpod.com. And please be sure to let us know if we can use your name on the show. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter @witchlitpod. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and consider giving us a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps other witches find the show. Thanks for listening and for reading Witchy.